All right, tough act to follow, right? I'm going to listen to you for another hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. I think one of the cool things is I'm a very big student of Theodore Roosevelt. My godfather is a guy by the name of Jim Posowitz, who wrote a book called Taking the Bullet for Conservation, among three others, about Roosevelt's coming back to try to save his legacy when Taft starts to really take that away. But learning today about the Grand Canyon and, you know, the part there about erosion is something new for me, for example. It's one I would use for sure. So my name is Lan Tawney, and I'm the president and CEO of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We're a national nonprofit, members in all 50 states. We really want to make sure that you have access to your public lands and waters and then the fish and wildlife habitat when you get there. So you have this guy named Lan standing in front of you, and I've been able to meet quite a few people, and they're like, so did you change your name because of the work you're in? And my quick one is yeah, I did it 2 years ago. And they laugh, and they're like, oh, really? And I'm like, no. So the next question is were your parents hippies? I was born in 1975, so they were in that era, but they were not your typical hippies. That's short hair, not long hair. And that's not where it came from. I really, just quickly, who knows who Charles Lindbergh was? Spirit of St. Louis flies across the Atlantic Ocean. He has a son named Lan Lindbergh who lives in the Blackfoot Valley, just outside of Missoula, Montana. You know, he's in his late 70s now, and I'm named after him. And it's my parents and kind of legacy pieces like Mr. Posowitz and Mr. Lindbergh have brought me to where I am today. You know, one of the things that Douglas has talked about is this legacy that Roosevelt gave us. And this legacy that he gave us, it didn't happen by accident, and there weren't people that applauded him necessarily the way. I mean, you hear about what happened with the Grand Canyon, you know, and that people didn't want him to set that aside. They wanted to exploit it. When he set aside the national reserves that are now the national forests, they were raping and pillaging those forests. And he didn't say no more cutting in those forests. He said, let's do it in a responsible fashion. But senators from my home state of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, they fought him and ultimately stopped him from being able to do that, and that's when he did the famous 21 Midnight Forest. And so, like, it was not done. They put him up on Mount Rushmore because of all the things he accomplished, but it was not like he was applauded the whole way, and I think we need to remember that. So that legacy is in trouble. I'm going to kind of talk about it in three different ways. First is the interior. Right? You have this Monuments Review that gets at the very heart of the Antiquities Act. This is not about trying to make sure that these things were done the right way. It's trying to like attack the Antiquities Act. It's trying to reduce monuments that were set aside to protect scientific reasons. I mean, you look at Mr. Zinke talks about bears, there's a reduction there. You look at Upper Missouri Breaks, which he says is okay. Tell me the artifacts that are in the Upper Missouri Breaks. That is done for scientific reasons, and it's now one of the best places to hunt bighorn sheep, elk, and mule deer in Montana. It's a coveted place. Sage grouse. Maybe notice the sage grouse announcement. They're going to look at undoing those plans that were worked on for decades by ranchers, by sportsmen and women, by the federal government, by state governments. They came up with a compromise to keep that bird off the list in these conservation plans. Now they don't want to fund those plans, and they want to change those plans, putting at risk not only that bird, but the sage steppe ecosystem, which has 348 different species, including pronghorn and mule deer, that are the corridors for their migrations are vitally important. You look at the Arctic, right? Talk about national wildlife refuges. Talk about Pelican Island. With the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is our refuge, we're talking about drilling there. And that was a compromise, right? On the North Slope, they said you can drill oil over here, but we're going to save the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Now they're talking about undoing that. The thing that I think scares me most about Zinke's rhetoric is when he talks about balancing the budget for the interior, right? These public lands weren't set aside to make sure that we had a balanced budget. They were set aside for all Americans. And so you talk about balancing the budget. One, I don't think there's any way he can do it. But what does that mean? That means reducing staff. And that means unfettered oil and gas development. So I think that's one that's super scary to me. You look at the EPA. They're doing a new Waters of the U.S. rule, right? Waters of the U.S., there's temporary wetlands and intermittent streams that were protected through millions and millions of comments in the Obama administration, put forth those new restored protections after they were taken away with Supreme Court case. And so why are these important? Temporary wetlands are what the duck factory is in like that North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana region, where you produce 70% of the ducks. These are temporary wetlands that are only wet during the spring. And why are they important? Because when they get wet, there's a ton of invertebrates in there, and these ducks can eat really well, which means they have higher clutches of young ducklings, and then the ducklings have something to eat really quickly when they have a lot of protein. Those protections for that go away, ducks are in trouble. Intermittent streams are also during the spring. They only run during the spring, and they're vital to spawning trout. So we take away those protections, what happens to our trout populations? I think the other one that the EPA is involved in is Bristol Bay. Bristol Bay has been this amazing, amazing place up in Alaska that has the largest, one of the largest salmon kind of runs in the world. And they're going to put all that at risk for a mine from a foreign-owned company. Foreign-owned. And so there's been a huge, you know, backlash. I think the, you know, the last administration was able to kind of stave off some things, but now there's talk of starting that again. The Agriculture Department, Mr. Pruitt is actually, Mr. Perdue, so far, so good there. I think there's been some talk about forest reform, which always makes me nervous. I mean, there's, I think markets are dictating right now our forest practices, which is not that much. But when you open that back up, just to kind of, you know, we have a big, huge fire season this last year in Montana, and how do you save that? Well, you cut our way out of it. There's no way you cut our way out of that. So when you hear that, it's, you know, it's troubling, but nothing has happened yet in the Department of Agriculture, but it's something to stay, I think, pay attention to. So there's some positive things going on, right? And I think, you know, the Secretary of Interior, Mr. Zinke, he's talking, the number one, you know, thing that's kind of facing enforcement right now, he said they talk about is lack of access. His first day on the job, he talks about increasing access to our public lands and waters, which was really a fluff secretarial order. And then about a month ago, he started a process where they're going to, I think it's a 45-day period, where they're going to look at how they actually do some of this stuff for real. I'm holding out hope for that. But I will say, that's like, don't look at what we're doing over here while we do this over here.
Yeah.
And we can have access to places, but if they don't have the fish and wildlife habitat when you get there, why do they want to have access to it? So I will say that's a positive, but you got to think about why that is a positive. He's also talked about the 1872 mine law reform. You know, that's part of the way potentially you could balance this interior budget when you have mostly, again, foreign-owned companies taking our hard rock minerals off of our public lands and paying zero royalties, like none. That's our stuff. We're not benefiting from all. And by the way, we get stuck with the cleanup. And so I think there's a potential positive there. And then the last one I would mention about a positive would really be, you know, this kind of forest fire fix. And so right now, Forest Service budget, over half of their money every year is spent on fighting forest fires. And so what happens then when they've had a budget that's been going down already over the last two decades? Is that they're forced to not do things that they should be doing, with that is like habitat improvement, keeping, you know, maintaining roads. And so that's fire season happens, and then all of a sudden they can't do anything for the rest of the year. They can't study, they have like wildlife biologists that are on the Forest Service, they can't do their studies anymore because they don't got any money. And so the fix that's being talked about, and I think Mr. Perdue has actually been very forthright about, is let's treat forest fires just like we treat other natural disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods. Get that off of their regular budget, so that they know what they have at the beginning of the year is going to be what they have at the end of the year, rather than having, you know, these big catastrophic fires, which are now the norm. And so I say these things, and, you know, like, what's the barometer? And how do we look at what's going on now and try to, like, figure out a path forward? And I think that question about what would Theodore Roosevelt do that Franklin Roosevelt talked about is what we need to ask ourselves now, is what would Theodore Roosevelt do? And I think, before I kind of talk about that piece, I think that out of, like, bad times, you look at the bad times, and you did such an eloquent job talking about them, I'm just going to touch on it a little bit, that market killing that was going on around the turn of the century, the 1900s, where we were killing elk and killing bison to put on tables in New York City, out of that came this idea that you cannot sell wild game. And so it was a great way to stop that market killing that was going on. The besides setting aside like Pelican Island to make sure that that we had places where birds weren't being shot for their feathers, it also became illegal to sell those feathers to women for their hats. You talk about the dirty 30s and where the prairie, like the lid kind of comes off the prairie. Some of the stuff Douglas talked about is right on the money. There's other things that happened at that point in the late 1920s. There's a thing called the Pittman-Robertson Act, which took excise taxes off of the ammunition and guns, and then put that back into wildlife management. You had the duck stamp that was penned in 1935. That duck stamp that hunters have to buy pays for national wildlife refuges. That's why they were able to add another, 550 of them, or I guess 500 of them. And that's going on today. We just increased the duck stamp a couple years ago, so now it's $25. And I pay that every single year. I bought my wife and my two kids, who don't hunt, duck stamps this year, knowing that money goes there. And not only am I doing that because there's more money, but I'm also teaching them a lesson. And I would tell all of you in here, that even if you don't hunt ducks, buy that stamp. If you know somebody at Audubon, tell them to tell all their people to buy that stamp. We need that help. And he talked about, in the 60s when rivers were literally on fire, and you get the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And then you look at now. Right? We're in another tough time. And what I'm trying to say is that out of all these tough times, good things happen. I think that's the way we need to look at it. And so part of the silver lining that I see with what's going on is that, one, it's an awakening. I think our conservation community was fairly complacent. I know the sportsman's community was. Our wildlife populations, besides mule deer and a couple others that we go out and hunt, are doing great. We have turkeys everywhere in this country right now. You have geese on every single golf course. You have white-tailed deer eating people's flowers where they're no longer like something beautiful to look at. They're a nuisance. We've done a really good job restoring wildlife in this country, and I think we've become a little complacent. So I think part of what's going on right now is hopefully that changes. Right? And I also think that there's this kind of growing constituency of like the outdoor users, and I'm talking about like the kayakers and the mountain bikers and the mountain climbers and the backcountry skiers. It's kind of, that's fairly new compared to like the hunting conservation history in this country. And at first they were focused really on access, and now they're starting to realize that they want to go to places that are beautiful too. And so if you watch what's happened over this last year, you look at Patagonia. Patagonia spends over $1 million in Montana alone to make sure that Mr. Zinke knows that there's people out there that don't want him to produce any monuments. An attack on one is an attack on them all. $1 million. They're bringing together REI, North Face, King, trying to get them to do the same thing. That is leadership. It took the outdoor retailer show out of Salt Lake City after years of threats. And reason, those politicians are the antithesis of our public lands. And so I think they're growing, and what I'm also seeing is this uniting of kind of like the hunting and fishing community and that community. And are we going to agree on every single thing? Probably not. But are we going to agree on probably 95% of that? I would say absolutely yes. And that this awakening of this kind of hornet's nest is something that I think that the silver lining that comes out of this, we're not going to win everything, and we're going to see some tough times. But as we bring those people together, I think that bodes well for the conservation history in this country. And so when you think about like how things get done, and again, none of this happened by accident, and you hear the big names, the Roosevelts, the Rachel Carsons, the Otto Leopolds, like those are all people we should know and should revere. There's also plenty of people that we don't know that stepped up. There's a story about a game warden down in Mississippi who, there's a bunch of guys killing a bunch of ducks out of season. He shows up at a baseball game and to arrest them. He's attacked with baseball bats for doing his job. Those people are on the front lines of conservation. And I don't remember his name, but I appreciate what he did. So I think there's opportunities for people to step up. And I think an example of that happened this year. So Congressman Chaffetz from Utah introduces a bill to sell 3 million acres of public land. Now, he's introduced this bill in previous Congresses, but there wasn't this awareness of what public lands really mean to us, that we all are public landowners. Right? We own 640 million acres. So he puts that bill forward on Wednesday, That next morning, we do Facebook Live. We're trying to utilize, you know, what the young kids are doing, though I feel like I'm still young. We had 500,000 people watch that. Then you had people like Stephen Renaud in the hunting community. You had Randy Newberg. You had Joe Rogan. Who knows who Joe Rogan is? He's a comedian. He's a fight commentator for MMA. It's the only time he's ever used his platform on social media to do something in a civic way. And so the calling card of that was keep it public, the hashtag. And so people started attacking Mr. Chaffetz on Instagram and going back months with pictures and just comments and putting keep it public everywhere. So a week later, Mr. Chaffetz comes out on Instagram, which I thought was really interesting, dressed in full camo, with a dog that obviously didn't hunt, and I don't think it was his. And he's holding the dog. You don't hold hunting dogs. You let them hunt. And he said, okay, I've heard the people. And he ends with a hashtag, keep it public. That's power. The squeaky wheel in this country still gets the grease, right? And so I think, you know, that's an example, and I'll say that I've been doing this for 17 years. I have never seen a congressman introduce a bill and then pull back the support for that bill a week later, ever. And I would like to look through history and see if that's really happened before this. And so that showed power. Now, is keeping public lands in public hands, like, that's just the tip of the iceberg, right? We got to make sure that we have the fish and wildlife habitat when we get there. But what it showed is that we have that power. And so why is that important? I'm going to tell you a little story about my daughter. So this last summer, I got invited on a media tour into the Frank Church Wilderness. And it was with a bunch of those brands that I talked about before, as well as some hunting brands and a bunch of outdoor riders. And it happened to fall on my daughter's birthday. And I said, I can't do it. I said, well, does she want to come? So I barely had it out of my mouth. My 9-year-old daughter's like, I want to go. And so we go, and the anticipation is super high. We have llamas that are going to help pack us in. Sid gets to pack her own llama. And like the first mile is pretty flat. And the next mile gets a little bit steeper. And then that final mile up to that lake, which if you've ever gone up to a lake, you know that that's that last crest before you get up to there, to this high mountain lake. So it's getting harder. It's super hot out. It's like 95 degrees. And she goes silent. And her and I, when we go silent, there's something going on. And so I know that she needs to eat. You know, we're with a group of people. Hey, it's 15 minutes till lunch. Well, that turns into 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes. Finally, we stop for lunch, and Sydney has had it. And so there's a creek right there, and I make her dunk her head in the water, and that starts to help a little bit. She gets some food, but she starts crying. She's like, I want to go home, and I want my mom. And I've never, ever heard that from her in the woods. So as a dad, you're like, man, you totally screwed up. But then I thought a little bit about what I could talk to her about. And Theodore Roosevelt is a much talked about icon in our household. And Douglas brings up the asthma piece. Like, Roosevelt, like, worked so hard to get over the asthma, right? And that could have been a debilitating thing that just kept him out of the woods. And instead of doing that, he fought and fought and fought, literally with his fist sometimes, but exercise was a major piece of his life. So I told her this story. And let that sink in for a minute and left her. Then I came back to her. The color of her face had returned a little bit. She wasn't so hot anymore. And she's like, I'm going to do this. She beat adults up to this lake. When she got to the top of the lake, she raised her hand like a triumph. And that grit that she showed right there is why these public lands are so important. This adventure that we can still have. I mean, that's besides the clean water and the clean air, besides the $887 billion that's generated from the outdoor economy every single year, it's that place where you can challenge yourself, you can find that solace, right? But that grit, that little lesson that she learned right there is something she'll carry with her for the rest of her lives. And that is like absolutely, absolutely important. And so as we are in these tough times, you know, I think we have broad shoulders as conservationists in this country. And you look at our history, again, it has not happened by accident. It's our time, right, to have those broad shoulders. I think you all have that Theodore Roosevelt bully pulpit that he talked about. You have the ability to communicate to people and get this story out there. So I have a lot of confidence in the people of America, and I have a lot of confidence in you. So thank you.
Thank you so much
to both of you. That was wonderful. Is the mic on? Mm-hmm. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
So we have time for questions, and I hope there are some great questions out there, and I'll take the moderator's prerogative for the first question. Dr. Brinkley, I think you left a lot of people hanging when you said, I don't think you know just how bad it is in Houston. And so being from Houston, I wondered if you could follow up that comment. And on CNN, did you call Donald Trump unfit to govern or something like that? And I wondered if you ever heard from him after that tweet or otherwise. So if you could answer those two. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, as you all know, their hurricane hit New Orleans last night, and I wrote a book once called The Great Deluge on Hurricane Katrina, and I had to look at climate change, and these are what's the beginning of a series of climate events. Now, this is our fourth hurricane here in a row hitting America. So a lot of this story, as journalists, I think, have to start finding ways to make climate change brought in the conversation more and more. I'm the historian at CNN, and they don't always love it. Nobody tells me that, but they don't say, oh, the climate got preacher, you know. But we got to keep writing about climate in the newspapers and journals and blog. We just got to do it. This is your job. Because it's not, you know, you could never 100% prove this particular Puerto Rico was climate and all that. But now in Houston, where I'm at, it's, you know, I'll just pick one. Right at San Jacinto Monument, big monument. Texans, it's where the birth of Texas, the Lone Star State, all that Texas pride. The Alamo was against Mexico, but this monument against Mexico was the big victory in Sam Houston. And they built it taller than the Washington Monument. It's the biggest monument outside of, it's in Houston, it's giant. All around it is Superfund site. It's a toxic waste site. Well, when the waters of Harvey hit, all of this toxic waste is gone all into neighborhoods, drinking water systems. It's an environmental disaster zone going on in parts of Houston. It's such a large city, it's not all of it, but in parts of it right now. And it is a major issue, I think, like Flint, on environmental justice issues. And where are these superfights being, Superfund sites, and people that live there, illnesses connected to Superfund sites. When you call it Superfund, it's such a pretty word almost. It's like a Superfund. I live by a Superfund, you know. When, you know, we're talking about really a toxic public health crisis going on. And some of it, the environmental justice movement actually began in Houston in the 70s. And we need to do so much work on environmental justice. I mean, it's hard to pick what it all is, but was Cesar Chavez fighting against pesticides, is that an environmental justice movement, or some of what Martin Luther King was doing, you know? But these poor neighborhoods are getting killed by having schools and the like with dump sites right at them. In Houston, it's the African-American Latino communities, you know, where the petrochemical capital, and for years they've just dumped stuff in the wetlands up there. So there needs to be a movement in Houston to do that, which we've been trying, a Lone Star National Recreation Area, but a ways to start reclaiming some of these superfights, rehabilitating the land. In Texas, guy running against Ted Cruz, the congressman from El Paso, is right now trying to take the Casner Range, which was a Cold War ammunition mine site, clean it, sweep it, and turn it into a national monument. So the point being, I think some of the energy that writing has to be about now is how does one take abused areas and reclaim it to make it habitable and productive areas for communities? And you know, there are going to be a lot of class action suits coming out of Houston, I promise you. It's just not making the news now because of Puerto Rico and Vegas and, you know, it's just been so speedy, and Trump hijacks the agenda with every tweet, and it's hard to focus. But you'll be hearing more about Houston coming up as some of the evidence is starting to be presented of what occurred down there.
Who has a question? Yes. Please say who you are.
Oh, John Addison, freelancer. You talked about the book you're researching and writing in 1969. Could you expand on the impact of the Santa Barbara oil spill and what Gaylord and Nelson did to help start the Earth Day?
The question is about Dr. Brinkley's new book on the Silent Spring Revolution and what was the impact of the Santa Barbara oil spill and Gaylord Nelson's Earth Day.
Interesting about Santa Barbara is Harold Ickes, who I mentioned, got fired by Harry Truman after being the longest, he was Secretary of Interior, 33 to 46. He got fired because he whistleblew on sweetheart offshore oil deals that were being made there, and they went after big oil. Truman got rid of him. When the spill hits in 69, it is a game changer, because by this point, California has become the epicenter of environmental thinking. It's because of the Sierra Club operating out there. It's because of senators like Cranston. It's because of the fights against nuclear power facilities. It's about the Point Reyes National Seashore Movement to save it. It's about the Redwood Movement in the 60s. Everything's coming out of California, and the environmental community was so intense, and then they got the black eye of the Santa Barbara spill, and it made the entire state of California just cringe. Remember, Nixon was from California, and they'd been in, and so the... it's the big impetus. Gaylord Nelson, who he mentioned, the senator of Wisconsin, starts picking up on moving. And the big deal is we've got to get something like an EPA going. Gaylord is really the most important senator for creating Earth Day, you know, along with student groups around the country. And Mayor Lindsay of New York City played a big role. And again, guys, Earth Day is you guys created Earth Day. Because it did bubble up, but the media, by night after Santa Barbara in 69, started covering journalism to the point that that first Earth Day was covered on live TV. Cronkite sat with Barry Commoner as his echo anchor. Echo buddy, Barry Commoner, Earth Day all over. And they trained cameras in different cities, and it just created the story of the environment as being the big one of its time. I think Santa Barbara is the key. It's that right in a row. Santa Barbara, rivers on fire, and first Earth Day, and senators like Gaylord Nelson, Ed Muskie, Frank Church, who you mentioned, the wilderness, these characters were really staying on the job, proud conservationists, and they made a difference. And it not only is about Earth Day being created or the EPA, but this spat of legislation that Nixon was forced to do in 72, 73, and 74.
Yes.
Aaron Weiss from Center for Western Priorities. Secretary Zinke loves to talk about the John Muir model versus the Pinchot model, and he's trying to follow the Pinchot model, sustained yield, multiple use. In what you've seen so far, is he actually following the Pinchot model, or is it something different?
This is the question is about whether Secretary Zinke is really following the Gifford Pinchot model of management.
Well, you know, Pinchot was a great man of his time, and he was the scientific forester. My admiration for him knows no bounds. But by picking that, it was his backing off of saying, "I'm a Theodore Roosevelt conservationist." The original Zinke was, "I'm a Theodore Roosevelt," and like our friend here, they started realizing, wow, TR said that, TR did this, TR was that progressive, that he started backing off. He likes the idea of the macho image of TR, and he was a SEAL, Navy SEAL, and TR was a Rough Rider in the war. So I think a lot of his life, Theodore Roosevelt was his hero, but now he's pivoted to saying Pinchot, who is much more about using public lands, wise use, utilitarian use. So he's kind of backtracked. The problem he has with that is not that many people today know that much about Gifford Pinchot. It's like, "I'm a Pinchotian," isn't TR. So he's kind of got himself, I think, in a little bit of a bind there. Pinchot was a great, great, great person in this state. But for example, I have some problems with the national parks, guys. I mean, go, you know, Edward Abbey called like Zion National Parking Lot, and the overcrowded tourism that goes to some of these parks. But here in Pennsylvania, this Allegheny should have been a giant national park. It would have helped tourism, because most parents taking kids places don't say, let's go to the national forest. They go to the passport to the parks. And so Pinchot didn't want any national parks in Pennsylvania because he was a national forest guy. Forestry is in agriculture. It's a debate for the U.S. Forest Service in the Department of Agriculture. Now with Zinke, you have the head of Interior saying his model is the Department of Agriculture, which is about using and selling natural resources. His talking Pinchot is not good for a Interior Secretary, because he's playing more into the mining outfits that you so eloquently put on letting foreign countries come in. It's just the dollar factor, I'm afraid. You want to add maybe to that?
Yeah, I mean, I've known Mr. Zinke for a while, and I think, you know, the president came out, had his first speech after the election in North Carolina, and said he was going to be the best conservation president since Theodore Roosevelt. Look up that speech. It's in there. And then you have Mr. Zinke, who's still, I think he's pivoting to Mr. Pinchot, but he's also still talking about Mr. Zinke or Mr. Roosevelt. And I will tell you, I don't talk about trying to follow in Roosevelt's footsteps, because those are darn big boots to fill. And so I think, you know, I mean, again, like, this idea of wise use, I think, is actually a good one, right? And it's in a multiple use. So you have these places that are protected, like national parks. You have places like Bureau of Land Management lands that are a much different ballgame. But they're managed for multiple use, which means you do set things aside. And, like, that's what this monument review is all about. And so when he's talking about trying to, let's say, undo bear's ears so they can, you know, extract coal from that landscape, we're only talking about 11 million acres in that whole review, and why, like, does he get to arbitrarily talk about what the people wanted and not what he wants? And it's a select few that are trying to do that. So he may be veiling that in Pinchot, but he's kowtowing to big industry is what I think.
Who has one more question? Yes. It's a good question. The question is about how we accurately cover this story when, if I understand the question right, it's a very small percentage of people, and this came up in a lot of panels. It's everything from climate change to conservation lands, a very small percentage of people's opinion are out there in the mainstream, right? So this got talked about at the Conservation Lands panel. So how do we as journalists deal with that? Is that the question? Who wants to? Okay.
It's a great question. And Nate over there, I talked to earlier, he was asking about Bernard DeVoto. We used to write Harper's essays about conservation, one after the other, after the other, during the dark, dark days of the early sagebrush rebellion of the 40s and 50s, during Truman Eisenhower and what was happening to public lands. I do think it takes a column, and unfortunately, we don't have that columnist right now. Elizabeth Colbert does great climate work with The New Yorker. Tim Egan logs in once in a while for The New York Times from the West, but it's very seldom and not sustainable. So I think if one of you wanted to try to step up, and I would aim to try to go back to Harper's, like make an appointment with the editor of Harper's. For example, they're surviving, or The Atlantic right now, and try to see if you can get a column on the public lands and climate, and with the idea of calling out abusers. That's what they did very well, DeVoto. Who's the bad guys? And if you're going to have to demonize one person or to get an issue done, and that's an unlucky person. But, you know, you saw the left do that with the Koch brothers in an attempt by drum beating the Koch brothers, Koch brothers, Koch brothers. I'm not sure they were successful, but it got close to being successful. We're not having the intelligent debate on this, and if you just do an article, it's hard because next day's news comes, but those columns last, columns become a book for you. One of you might want to think about trying to do that with your careers.
More than one of you.
I think that, who remembers like what happened at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge? You know, the Bundy Bunch takes over, right? And out of that, one of the things that they talked about was they want to return those lands to the people, right? Well, who are those people? Those people are like a small fraction. And I think while that dialogue got a little weird for a second, it also created this opportunity to everybody understand that we all are public landowners. We own 640 million acres. So I think telling the people that, like, they don't know. They don't know. So I think that's a big piece. And the second thing I would say is that Katie Enders did a public land series for The Guardian. It was like the number one thing that they did for like a couple weeks. And people from all over the world were looking at that. And why are they looking at that? Because we are the envy of the world and what we have. And we have to constantly try to fight to keep it. And so I think like pitching editors on the importance of this, obviously, I mean, it's a good thing, but I think readership is hungry for it, too. I think it's very hungry for it. So I think pitch those ideas.
So I'm going to turn it back over to Don to say goodbye. But before I do, I just wanted to say, you know, one thing I really like about Doug Brinkley's books is that he always finds that journalist. He finds that journalist or writer who was right in there telling the story and helping make the change, too. So, like, Century Magazine editor Robert Underwood Johnson, John Burroughs, the cartoonist Ding Darling, Walter Cronkite, and of course Rachel Carson, who he's working on now. So I think that, you know, gives us and leaves us with a lot of hope that our work indeed is helping form the environmental legacy of the future. So I thank you both so much for being here. It's been a great panel. Thanks. Thank you.